Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Thursday, November 20th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Moscow Community Investment Co-op announces board members and bylaws. The for-profit group seeks to keep community control of downtown. Idaho's wildfire fund is down to $15 million and will need infusion of cash for the 2026 fire season. 15 ICE detainees in the Wilder ICE raid released due to due process violations. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Reports. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. ICE has been forced to release 15 of the people it wrongly detained during the October 19th raid at the La Catedral Arena horse racing venue in Wilder. Senior U.S. District Judge B. Lynn Windmill ordered the 15 released because of lack of due process and unlawful confinement. ICE says it arrested 105 people at the racetrack that day due to immigration violations. Reports from the scene say ICE and other cooperating law enforcement agencies detained 400 people for a time before taking the 105 away. The ICE raid came in conjunction with an FBI raid that netted 5 arrests for organizing illegal gambling. The horse races themselves were legal, however. The Idaho Press reported families greeted 8 of the released from the Elmore County Jail last night. The paper reported authorities released 7 more detainees from jails across southern Idaho. ICE officers zip-tied and interrogated citizens, legal residents, and non-citizens during the raid. The FBI released a statement after the raid saying reports suggesting children were zip-tied or hit with rubber bullets during the October 19th FBI-led operation in Wilder are completely false. The Idaho Press published a photo of the 14-year-old daughter of Annabelle Romero with her wrists zip-tied at the raid. The FBI later released an amended statement saying reports suggesting young children were zip-tied or hit with rubber bullets during the October 19th FBI-led operation at Wilder are completely false. One of the memorandum that Judge Windmill wrote ordering the release of the detainees said the person was released because he is a decades-long U.S. resident with no criminal record. Windmill wrote, the government identified no information establishing the person is a danger or flight risk. He wrote, it's only apparent interest in detaining, which imposes additional fiscal and administrative burdens, is to fulfill an arrest quota of 3,000 immigration arrests per day set by the current administration. The memorandum went on to say the person was held without a bond hearing, violating their Fifth Amendment right to due process. It also said the person was detained alongside convicted criminals and conditions they were held in were indistinguishable from criminal incarceration with a loss of contact with family, loss of ability to work, and lack of privacy. The Moscow Community Investment Co-op, which is a new community for-profit real estate investment group for residents and investors to pool their resources to collectively purchase, restore, and manage properties in Moscow, held a meeting yesterday to introduce the public to its board and to update the public on its progress. The organization plans to provide a path for people to work together democratically to sustain community values. The Moscow Community Investment Co-op officially became a business in August when it incorporated. The organization recently created bylaws and opened a bank account. According to the co-op's website, the organization is committed to equitable opportunities for participation in all aspects of the community's social and economic life. The organization has more than 300 people who have pledged their support. Board President Ben Calabretta said, we're going to need a lot of people involved for the co-op to be successful. We're in this together. Moscow Community Investment Co-op Secretary Phil Shin, who is an urban forester, said the organization, quote, is an opportunity for those of us who live in the community to dictate what happens downtown. The new business is looking for Latah County residents to become voting members by purchasing shares for $1,000 each. Idaho residents who live outside of Latah County can purchase investment shares that do not come with a vote. The Mosca Community Investment Co-op is seeking donations to cover startup costs, which include $15,000 to cover legal fees, $4,000 for bookkeeping services, $2,500 for website development, and $1,100 for insurance. Kyla Bretta, who is also Washington State University Center for Civic Engagement Director, said the organization plans to purchase properties after it collects more members. According to the Daily News, the board's vice president is local real estate agent J.T. Manning, former WSU College of Education director Bev Rhodes is treasurer, WSU research associate Allie Bean is outreach director, and former Latah County assessor Pat Vaughn is also on the board. Idaho Department of Lands officials say the state's Wildfire Suppression Fund will drop to $15 million by the end of the year. Lands Department officials say the 2025 fire season cost the state more than $40 million. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, at Tuesday's Land Board's meeting, Lands Department Director Dustin Miller said the 2025 fire season cost the state about $59.3 million in fire suppression costs. And he expects the state to recoup about $18.6 million through reimbursement agreements and partnerships to bring the total cost of this year's state firefighting efforts to $40.6 million, leaving a balance of around $15 million in wildfire suppression funds for next year. The $40.6 million spent this year is less than the 2024 fire season when the state spent $59 million on firefighting. Miller said the state will be responsible for almost $5 million in fixed costs next year. Governor Brad Little said depending on the severity of next year's fire season, firefighting costs could rise to over $10 million for a single fire when helicopters, crews, and other equipment is factored in. Little said, by the time you contract for helicopters and the airplanes and the crews and everything, it's well over $10 million. I'm just trying to figure out what the budget request needs to be so we don't have to do deficiency warrants. The reduced leftover balance means state officials will have to find additional funding for fire suppression at a time when all state agencies, except public K through 12 education, are dealing with 3% holdbacks due to this year's estimated $58.3 million state budget deficit. Joint Finance Appropriations Committee members have signaled the 2026 budget will be tight as lawmakers will concentrate on trimming departmental budgets rather than approving new expenses, which could make the deficit higher. Little said he does not want the firefighting debt to increase and that he favors pre-funding the Wildfire Suppression Fund to ensure enough money is available for next year's fire season. In a February letter to the Land Board, the governor wrote, backing the Fire Suppression Deficiency Fund means Idaho's wildland firefighters can focus on aggressively protecting timber, lands, property, and people without funding delays, and lawmakers can enter next year's budgeting cycle without a deficit due to wildfire suppression. The Land Board members are Governor Brad Little, Secretary of State Phil McGrain, Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador, Idaho State Controller Brandon Wolf, and Idaho Superintendent of Public Instruction Debbie Critchfield. The board gives direction to the Department of Lands, which is responsible for fire suppression on state lands. State lawmakers will be setting the budget for the Department of Lands fiscal year 2027 during next year's legislative session, which begins January 12th. Idaho State Police have found the vehicle, which they suspect was involved in a fatal car crash in Plummer Friday evening. The Daily News reports police say a 2008 Chevrolet Silverado LT with Washington license plates registered to a Spokane resident was the vehicle involved in the accident which killed a pedestrian in Plummer Friday. No details about the vehicle's owners have been made public. According to an Idaho State Police news release, witnesses at the scene said They saw a pickup truck traveling north on U.S. Highway 95 strike a woman crossing the roadway Friday about 5 p.m. The witnesses said the vehicle failed to stop, turned around, and proceeded south on the highway. Emergency responders failed to resuscitate the woman, who was pronounced dead. Idaho State Police offered their thanks to the public for tips, which helped locate the truck. Whitman County deputies arrested 67-year-old Lawrence Krebel of Garfield yesterday for possession of methamphetamine with the intent to deliver. A Whitman County Sheriff's Department news release said deputies contacted Krebel early Wednesday morning at the junction of Grinnell Road and State Route 67 near Palouse. Police say Krebel admitted to deputies there was methamphetamine in his vehicle, which deputies seized. Police say they seized drug paraphernalia, which they found under the seat of Krebel's car. Krebel told law enforcement he had intended to meet someone to deliver the drug. The investigation is continuing.
A new executive order from Oregon Governor Tina Kotek directs state agencies to put more energy towards making the state's ecosystems and economies more resilient to climate change. The order sets a decade-long goal to protect and restore an additional 10% of the state's lands and waters. Nils Christofferson is with Wallawa Resources, a nonprofit based in Northeast Oregon. He praised the governor's order for its strong vision, especially the idea that healthy ecosystems and healthy local economies go hand in hand.
If we can focus our programs, policies, and investments to support the families and individuals who steward these lands with clear guidance about the targets, I think that's where we'll see tremendous benefit for rural Oregon and more broadly for the state.
The order directs state agencies to identify science-backed strategies to respond to intensifying droughts, wildfires, heat, and sea level rise brought about by climate change. A 2021 proposal from the Oregon Climate Action Commission found that natural and working lands reduced U.S. emissions by 12% in 2019, and that protecting and restoring them could double this reduction. Hannah Epstein of the nonprofit Oregon Shores says the state's coastal communities are among its most rural and economically vulnerable. People on the coast depend heavily on fishing and tourism, she says, and they are already feeling the impacts of sea level rise, which is motivating them to become more resilient in the face of climate change.
Resilient estuaries can support resilient fisheries. Resilient dunes and wetlands can protect our homes and our roads. Resilient oceans will support tourism and even the cultural identity of many coastal communities.
Christofferson says while setting goals that are attainable is important, the 10% in 10 years goal as laid out in the governor's order falls short of what is needed to achieve resilience in eastern Oregon from climate-driven disturbances such as fire, insects, and disease.
If you're looking at a watershed of just, for example, 100,000 acres, you want to treat 30 to 40% of that in order to achieve resilience for the entire watershed.
Both Christofferson and Epstein say they're looking forward to working more closely with state agencies on climate resiliency projects. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Hungadunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Hungadunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at hungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram.
A former NASA science journalist from Montana is speaking out after she says the agency edited climate change out of her work. Bozeman resident Karen Kirk will speak at Montana State University tonight, Thursday, as part of Climate Week on campus. She says she first noticed the shift last year, right before the presidential election, which took her by surprise. She says editors changed the content of a ready-to-publish article on glacial melt, softening it and removing some references to human-caused climate change.
We were always careful, but this was out of the blue. To go in after it had been reviewed by scientists and editors, after it was ready to be published, to make a big change like that was That was definitely new.
She says things only got worse for her and her colleagues after the election. She worked as a NASA contractor, and the agency let her go in August. She says NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory cut the rest of her team in October as part of larger layoffs. NASA says the cuts were due to budget constraints and downsizing. The agency says it's moving away from scientific research to focus on space exploration. Kirk maintains the agency had always been careful not to advocate, but instead present results supported by scientific evidence. She says she decided to push back internally against the new approach, which she describes as uncomfortable.
I realized that my main duty was to earth science and climate science, and if that put me at odds with some of my peers, then so be it. And it took a lot of soul searching to get to that point.
This is the first time Kirk is speaking publicly about her experiences at NASA, aside from a few guest lectures on college campuses. She says she knows she's taking a professional risk, but believes it's important for her and others in the scientific community to take a similar stance. She adds her talk isn't just about what happened to her.
It's much more about some degree or another. Many of us are in this kind of situation right now. So what do we do? And what are sensible risks? And what does it look like to lean in and lead? When is it better to just play it safe? That's the conversation I want to have.
Kirk will speak from 6 to 8 o'clock tonight at Montana State University. I'm Laura Hatch, Big Sky Connection.
Transgender people lost to acts of violence are being honored today, even as more anti-transgender legislation is introduced in the U.S. and violence against them has increased. November 20th is Transgender Day of Remembrance, set aside to raise visibility of transgender people and acknowledge the community's contributions to society. Mateo Nevels with the Lavender Rights Project says the current political climate is contributing to the dehumanization of trans people.
National narratives are designed to erase us. We're not your political scapegoat. We're not something that people should use to score points. We're human beings, and we deserve for our humanity to be honored.
The first Day of Remembrance was held in 1999 in both San Francisco and Boston to honor the memory of Rita Hester, a transgender African-American woman murdered in Massachusetts a year earlier. Now observed across the U.S. and in many other countries, Neville says events often include candlelight vigils, marches, and memorial services where the names of those lost to violence are read. Neville says even though the day is marked by grief, it's also a time for joy and honoring a commitment to end transphobia and the violence it can generate. While prejudice can start small with judgment or misunderstanding, Neville says acknowledging its effects can help disrupt the silence that often accompanies violent acts.
They always happen to the most marginalized people in a group of folks, and people are often confused as to how it got so far, and this is so unprecedented. And the reality is it's baked into the fabric of what we're used to dealing with, but it doesn't mean that we should have to continue to endure that.
Data from the group Every Town for Gun Safety show that between 2017 and 2023, 263 transgender or gender expansive people were homicide victims, and the majority were killed with a gun. Black trans women are targeted more than others, and a disproportionate number of anti-trans violence occurred in southern states. I'm Roz Brown, Washington News Service.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, mostly cloudy tonight, low 31, patchy fog after 9 p.m. Partly sunny tomorrow, high 46, partly cloudy Friday night, low 31. Mostly sunny Saturday, high 48, mostly cloudy, low 33 Saturday night. 30% chance of rain after 10 a.m. Sunday, mostly cloudy, high 49. 70% chance of precipitation Sunday night, rain likely before midnight, then rain likely possibly mixed with snow. Snow level 5,500 feet, lowering to 4,100 feet after midnight, otherwise mostly cloudy, low 30. Little or no snow accumulation expected. 50% chance of rain and snow on Monday. Snow level 2,800 feet, partly sunny, high 41. Currently 37 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. there. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant night. Flashpoints is up next. At 7:30, we'll have Appearing Locally, where we feature music from artists that are appearing in the Moscow Pullman area in the near future until 8 o'clock. And then we'll have First Wave on the air, syndicated rock music show, and 9 to 11, Connecting the Notes. At 11 o'clock, recorded jam band concert with The Ride till 1 a.m. Stay tuned for more KRFP Moscow Pullman.